Hello, once again, welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we convene the Science Forum, and we have gathered our panel of science experts to respond to your questions and comments. You know, sometimes we'll do this show with two scientists, and it's just fine. Sometimes, most of the time, with three, and that's great. But today, we have four scientists in the room. That means someone is bound to have the answer to something. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. And you can also check in on wamc.org/voxpop and comment there, or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But we love your calls. 800-348-2551 is the number. And without further ado, let's have our panel of scientists sign in, please.
I'm Ivor Gaber. I'm a biophysicist, and I work for Applied Biophysics.
Nice to have you back, Ivor.
I'm George Shaw. I'm retired from teaching at Union College and doing research on a variety of fields.
All right.
Ed Stander from SUNY Cobleskill. I teach astronomy, geology, environmental science, and anything that Fred can't answer.
Fair enough. And Fred is?
Fred, I'm an adjunct at SUNY Cobleskill, past president of the Science Teacher Association of New York State. I teach chemistry.
Well, all right. And nice to have you guys here. And let's get right to the phones at 800-348-2551. Fred in Hyde Park, you're first on the Science Forum today.
Hey, I'm wondering why clouds are flat on the bottom. I'm going to hang up so I can listen on the radio.
So why clouds are flat on the bottom. All right, Fred, thanks. All right, so panel, what do you think?
Go for it.
Uh-oh, Fred is already shrugging off the first question.
This is really
depressing. He's like a regular.
Yeah. Clouds are flat on the bottom because the water in the atmosphere has to get to a point where it actually forms little raindrops to form a cloud. And that requires you to get to what's called the dew point. And so as you go up in the atmosphere, air cools off, and it comes to a point where it's finally cold enough to start forming nucleating particles. And that is a certain distance from the ground, and therefore this sort of this flat area where you finally reach the right temperature where it can happen, and that's where it happens. So that's called the dew point.
George, are you buying that?
Sounds okay to me.
All right, Ivor, is that all right with you?
I'm fine.
Okay, so that's one down. Well played, Fred in Hyde Park. Thank you. Jason in Spencertown, you're next.
Good afternoon. I've heard this comment by climate science deniers. They say that CO2 in the atmosphere follows temperature change, and not what climate scientists are saying, that CO2 precedes temperature change in the atmosphere. Now, does this happen simply on a seasonal basis, like in the fall, the temperature gets colder, and then the CO2 level goes up as the leaves decay in the ground, or is there something more to it?
Okay.
No, that comes from the ice in Greenland and maybe South Pole and stuff. And it turned out that the temperature goes up first, and a few hundred years later, the CO2 comes up. And so therefore, the people, I'm a climate denier, if you want to call it that, and that makes the people who think that CO2 causes global warming very worried.
Okay, that's Ivor. And anybody else want to weigh in here?
Well, I'll give a quick one.
Ed Stander.
There is a seasonal change in carbon dioxide that's measured. There's actually a place in Hawaii that does this continuously. And it goes up very slightly, goes down very slightly as a function of temperature, partially because the ocean is able to suck up more carbon dioxide when it's colder than when it's warmer. And so there's a buffer, if you will, in the ocean that keeps things straight to some extent. So the little variations are associated with that.
And also the thing grow more in the summer.
Yeah.
It uses more CO2 in the summer.
Right.
I think it's the growth cycle.
Okay. Anybody else here? We're good. 1-800-348-2551. Another satisfied customer. CJ in Sharon, Connecticut. You're up. CJ, are you there?
Oh, not Connecticut.
I'm sorry.
State.
You're in Sharon?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought you were in Connecticut. Go ahead.
Okay, saliva, how is it made? How does it get into your mouth? And, you know, I would like to know things about it. And also, I have a little garden that I make things that I eat, grow things that I eat. And I have those little black flies, they seem to be in the soil. What can I put in the soil that wouldn't harm the plant, but take care of the and black fruit flies.
All right, anybody?
Wow.
Well, saliva is made in the salivary glands that are located underneath the skin of your face. And the saliva contains digestive enzymes, which start the digestion process in your mouth. And then it continues, of course, after you swallow and the food gets to your stomach. As for the flies, I think it probably would be worth your while to carefully look at them and see if these flies are actually doing anything to your food. They may or may not be. So it may be a problem that you don't have to think about.
All right. CJ, thanks a lot for the call. It's the Science Forum on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551. One open line at the moment. Jonathan in Norfolk, you're on.
Gentlemen, I want to talk to you about a problem I've got. I'm talking to my 14-year-old daughter about science and religion. And what I'm trying to say to her is that most religions were formulated in a pre-scientific age, and that people were making sense of phenomena around them in a miraculous way. But that since the Enlightenment, we have actually, and the promise of science being able to explain and rationalize logically everything,
all
and
right.
therefore religion becomes redundant. I'd like to see, I mean, we're having this go backward forward, and I'd like to have your views on all that.
All right,
so
well,
you can help me.
Let's start with Fred. Fred, go ahead.
Let me see. Religion is based a lot on science. Science created a lot of things that people thought about in their past life. Religion, I'm a Catholic, so we're based on, you know, what God has produced, and we believe in resurrection after the dead. I'm not so sure where the people got this idea from at the beginning, but they are taking their people, every place buries their dead, they honor their dead, and they believe that these dead are going on to a greater place. And every religion has a higher authority, who they call God, or they call Allah, or they call Buddha, or they call Confucius, or whatever. And all of these religions are based a little bit on some type of science that was produced in the past.
How about you, George? You don't want to touch this, do you?
Well, I come from a very different background. I was raised a Baptist.
Okay.
I got better. I'm a scientist. I've been a scientist since I was a kid. I think it's a very good way to try to understand the physical world that we see around us. And it does an incredibly good job of doing that, and it provides a methodology for improving our knowledge of what we see around us. Where religion, I think, retains some relevance, even though we don't have to explain the sunrise from a guy riding a chariot or various and sundry other things, thunder from somebody banging an anvil with a hammer. We don't have to have those kinds of explanations anymore, but religion does provide us with a framework for making personal and, shall we say, moral, ethical decisions. I'm not saying that religion is essential for that, but it has provided a very long-standing and a reasonably firm basis for doing that.
Ivor?
Well, I agree with you. I think science has taken over, and I think that religion slowly is dying out, very slowly in the United States, much faster in Europe, and because we can explain most of the thing today, but the only thing left is how life gets started. And if you are religious, you think that God created man, but scientists know that the first thing that started was something like a bacteria. And the bacteria has developed according to Darwin's theory, and then suddenly we have appeared here. So I think religion is done for, but it'll probably take another 1,000 years.
Well, Jonathan, thank you for a most provocative question. We appreciate it very much. Nina in Hoosick. Nina, you're on the Science Forum.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This past summer, I saw a phenomenon that I have not seen before or since. At about 3 o'clock in the morning, looking out into a grove of pine trees, I saw, beginning at about 30 feet above the ground, reaching up about another 30 to 40 feet, an absolutely regular pulsation of light, absolutely beautiful, and it continued for about 45 minutes and then stopped. And I wondered if there is any explanation that any of you who are on the panel might have for that.
Okay, who wants first crack at this one?
I think you should have your eyes examined.
Ivor.
You know what? That's really insulting.
That is. He's only joking.
He's kind of a crackpot anyway about his climate change.
You know what, Nina? Thank you very much. Ed, you want to go ahead and try this?
Yeah, what you probably saw was a what's called an igneous fatuus, or a foxfire. And it usually forms on the top. Sometimes it forms on the tops of masts, where it's called St. Elmo's fire. It's got a number of different names. And it's associated with a charge of electrons at the top of a point, which usually is associated with a lightning strike, for example, where the electrons are being attracted to the clouds. The cloud's positive charge is being attracted to the bottom part. And it forms a static charge, which is very, very similar to lightning, effectively, but nowhere near as strong.
All right.
If that helps.
And would that account for the absolutely regular pulsation?
Oh, yeah. That's no problem, because it charges and discharges. If you look up Foxfire or you look up St. Elmo's fire, you can read a lot about it online.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Nina, thanks a lot for the call. And I should point out that Ivor's not a crackpot. Ivor is a prize-winning scientist. And, you can make jokes, and they're not insults. And it's everybody play nice. Let's take a break, Zach. We'll be back on this fun-filled edition of the Science Forum.
Support comes from Boyden & Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, providing foreign and domestic car, truck, and SUV repair services and a Massachusetts inspection station for over 50 years. BoydenAndPerrin.com. Edward Garbosik, Certified Financial Planner, Havoc & Wealth Strategies, Wilbraham, Massachusetts, providing customized financial retirement strategies for those approaching or in retirement. HavocAndWealthStrategies.com. The Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting the exhibition Ogden Pleissner, Watercolors and Oil Paintings, now through June 1st, arkellmuseum.org. And the Blue Marble, a world of gifts, Amherst, Massachusetts. Featuring handcrafted jewelry from around the world, thebluemarble.biz.
Vox Pop on WAMC, boys and girls, 1-800-348-2551, where everybody plays nice. It's the Science Forum, and, we're talking about St. Elmo's fire. And, 45 minutes is an awfully long time, Ed, for something like that to go on.
It sure is.
The mic's over there.
Yeah, there you are. Hi there. Yeah. It sure is, and it may not have been 45 minutes. What I'd like to have known, and I didn't ask, was whether there was lightning, thunder and lightning going on in the area. Whether it discharges and whether it was a stormy night, whether there's a lot of water in the atmosphere, because that usually helps make it happen.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Phones lines are loaded. Susan in Sunderland, Mass. Susan, you're on.
Hi. A question came up earlier about clouds, and the speaker said that the dew point is somehow connected with the clouds. And when we hear the weather reports, they talk about the dew point, which I thought was something connected with rain. And so if it's the making of clouds, I guess it is. So could we have a more detailed explanation of what is the dew point?
Dew point is a function of temperature and relative humidity. The two together define the dew point. I don't know the actual calculation, but basically The wetter the atmosphere is, the lower the the higher the temperature can be to still form clouds. And what the dew point is the point at which nucleation of water can occur within the atmosphere. If the dew point is, let's say, 35 degrees and the ground temperature is 35 degrees, then you have fog. If the dew point is 35 degrees and the temperature of the ground is much, much warmer, then the cloud will form higher up in the atmosphere. So depending on the difference between them, pretty well determines where the clouds will form.
Oh, because like in the spring, when the ground is cold and the air is warming up, we get fog.
That's correct.
And in the fall, when the earth is still warm and the air is cold, we get fog, and that's a cloud sitting on the ground.
It all depends on the humidity. If the relative humidity is high enough, then you can have a relatively high temperature and still get cloud formation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the two together that define what the dew point is.
Fred?
You can create it yourself in the summertime by picking a nice soda with ice in it and a nice warm, muggy day. You will notice that the beads of water form on the outside of the cup a lot quicker than they do on a dry, warm, hot day, a cold day. And it brings the moisture out of the air.
The technical definition is it's the temperature at which a given mass of air, reaches saturation. So it's the point where there's 100% saturation. If you go below that temperature, then the moisture in the air will start to condense. If you go above that temperature, then the air can take more water up.
All right, Susan, great question. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye now. 1-800-348-2551. Jamie in Plattsburgh is on. Hi.
Hi. I had the question about, I'm always getting shocked, like I would say, anytime I touch anything or anyone, and I was wondering if there's a way to ground myself.
Hmm. Well, you could sit quietly in a dark room and meditate for a... No,
teenagers are grounded, right?
We have this problem, too, in the studio. Every time I hit the studio door, metal, I'll shock myself. All right, let's go to our physicist first.
I don't know any way you can ground yourself. Maybe if you go barefooted.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
Go barefoot.
Go barefoot. I'll try that at work and see how that goes.
Well, it depends on where you work, Jamie. Well, anybody else want to have it?
If you have the problem in a car, what they normally say is to touch things with the key first, and that allows the key to get shocked rather than you. But I've also read, and I've never tried this, but you might try it, get one of these sheets that you put in a dryer to get rid of static cling, rub that against your seats of your car, for example, and that decreases the static charge that you would get. And so when you rub yourself against that seat and touch the door, it doesn't shock yourself.
Okay, I'll try it.
Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
Good luck. Here's one gentleman from Pamela on Facebook. Can a soft inflated ball act as a barometer? I have one that I use for posture, and some days it's quite firm, but others... it's kind of soft. I don't add or remove any air, and the changes apparently from day to day. Also, which condition does it represent? If it's firmer, does that mean we're having high pressure or low pressure? Great question.
Firmer means lower air pressure. No, firmer means that there's hot in the air, and the air expand in the ball and make it firm. If it's soft and it's cold.
Okay.
So the way you're measuring temperature, not a very accurate way.
Okay. Ed, you want to weigh in?
Go ahead, George. You're all set.
I think it depends. If the ball is in a room which is always at the same temperature, then temperature effects aren't going to affect the firmness because it's always at the same temperature. But if you've got a fixed amount of air in the ball and the air pressure in the room, that is the outside air pressure, goes lower, then the ball will try to expand and it will become firmer. If the air pressure is higher, then the ball will be compressed and it'll become squishier.
Okay, so there could be two things at work here. If the ball is in her car, it could also be temperature related.
Oh yeah, if you put it on the dashboard of your car, I don't know, this sounds like a Pilates ball. It might not fit on the dashboard of the car.
Listen,
but
I don't know.
But if you put it out in the sun, it's going to heat up, and yes, that will cause the air inside to expand, and it will become firmer.
And I'll say exactly the opposite.
Oh, okay.
that if you have a high pressure on the outside, it'll compress the air more on the inside, and therefore it'll become firmer.
All right, well, I think this is homework. I think that somebody
has to do... I don't have a Pilates ball.
Well, I don't know. You can work an experiment or two, right, for next time?
Been there, done that.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Boy, what a rancorous crowd we have today. Nikki in Saratoga. Nikki, you're on.
Yes, I'm calling in to answer the question for the person that called in before. He has a little garden and he has those little flies.
Oh, yeah.
They are actually fungus gnats. I have a little indoor garden. I'm a master gardener volunteer, and one thing he could do, he could get those, you know, those long long sticky fly traps that you could get, you know, at Agway, Allardyce.
Yeah.
And put it right beside the garden because they will multiply. They actually live in the dirt, but they will not affect the stuff, you know, that he's eating.
Okay. Great.
But they do multiply quick.
But they're
okay, Ed?
Yeah, I'm just saying. I think they're quite high in protein, so you might want to keep them.
Oh, very nice.
I don't know if I would want to. During the summertime, when you purchase soil, it's good to put it out on your driveway, you know?
Yeah.
You know, to let it really bake by the sun and then bring it in, because they do stay in all the soils, you know, that you buy.
Yeah. Well, that's great. So, Nikki, thank you very much for the call. It's cross-pollination of programs today. We have a little garden show going on as well. Alan in Watervliet. Alan, you're on.
Hi, I'm wondering, how do adhesives like glue and tape work? Do they work on a molecular level or an atomic level, and what forces do they, activate an adhesive? What, is it like nuclear, or is it a...
yeah, okay, we get it. Great question.
All right, I'm going to hang up to hear on the radio, okay? Well,
thanks, Alan, appreciate it. Go ahead, gentlemen. How do adhesives work? How do they work? That's a great question. A fair question. And you know what? He stumped the band. No.
Well, they're made out of sticky stuff.
Oh, boy. I'm a broadcaster, and I could have come up with that one. You guys are scientists.
How do they work?
Well, it's really sticky stuff, so it's a very good adhesive. It sticks to everything. I mean, you know, it's called Van der Waals forces.
All right, fair enough. So, yes. Alan, go ahead.
The Van der Waals forces might be it there, but the adhesives, probably the molecules on the adhesives are probably charged a little bit, and they're attracted to others, to non-charged particles, and they just stick together, like taking a balloon, rubbing it on your hair, and put it on the wall. That might be one of the ways it might work.
Well, but it wouldn't work on wood because there's no charges of wood. But it's most adhesive, what people that they glue wood together. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Well, it'd be the pieces, the molecules in the glue,
but they
adhere to both sides of the wood.
Yeah, but they're not charged.
But in the cases of wood, the glue is actually going into the wood fibers and then solidifying, so you're producing another material there. It's not an adhesive so much as it's a glue.
Well, what's the difference?
It's a very big difference.
If
you take a material and you put something inside, like an epoxy,
yeah,
for example.
Yeah, but what's the difference between a glue and adhesive? That's what I'm asking.
It's a surface phenomenon versus a deeper phenomenon. In an adhesive, you take a piece of tape and you put it down on your thing, and it sticks there.
Yeah.
So something's going on in the forces between the tape and the material, wood,
yes,
or whatever it is.
Yes.
In the case of glue, you're actually filling up the pores of the material with something that then hardens and becomes a new material as a result of that.
Well, I don't know. I'm not...
You're not convinced.
But isn't tape really the same thing? I mean, if you put tape on your hand, you'll feel a little sticky residue after you take the tape off. Isn't that the same as glue to some extent?
It could very well be, but then how does it stick to something which doesn't have pores?
I don't know. All right, let's go back to the
phones.
Okay,
we'll talk about this.
All right, nice call, by the way. Tommy in Canaan, Connecticut, you're on.
Hey, how are you? Thank you for taking my phone call.
Sure.
So my question is, I'm actually a pastry chef, and modern cooking has become more accepted, and people enjoy it, but GMOs are still socially not really accepted. And I was just wondering how the panel felt about that, and if there were any examples of how GMOs can actually be beneficial.
All right. Fair enough. Anybody want to try this one?
Well, there's certainly examples of how they can be beneficial if they increase agricultural productivity in places where the ability of local farmers to produce food is limited, they can end up feeding more people. Now, there are others that will say, yeah, but there's a price that you're paying for that. And, of course, like most things we do, there are all kinds of trade-offs. So I think it largely depends on the particular application of GMO that you're talking about, the particular location, the particular environment, the particular product that has been modified.
So specifically talking about genetically modified organisms in actual animals, not in...
In food crops.
Not in food crops, in actual...
In animals.
In animals, how salmon, now there's genetically modified salmon. And I can see, you know, how it's beneficial to increase productivity, mm-hmm. but isn't that really just increasing, profits and essentially not bettering, you know, the overall human health?
Well, the salmon has not been approved for consumption yet, but it definitely will be. And I'm from Norway originally, and Norway raised a lot of salmon. And in Europe, genetically modified food is illegal, at least in Norway it's illegal. So if they don't change, they're going to go broke, because it definitely will come.
Well, now, what are some of the dangers? You hear a lot of discussion about genetically modified organisms, and there are vague sort of statements that, you know, there are these threats posed by them. What does science know, and what do we know that is a real threat?
I just heard another Nobel Prize winner talking about that. And he was enraged, and he's going to sue the government in Europe because they do not allow golden rights. And he claimed that 12 million people die every year because they have bad diet. Golden rice has a vitamins in it, which is not in natural rice. And so genetically modified food is actually better than normal food.
Anybody else?
Well, the big danger, if you will, genetically modified food has the possibility of solving a lot of our problems. But at the same time, it's something that can occur so fast, and in this country especially, can occur without almost no oversight from the Food and Drug Administration, that if something is allowed to enter the food chain and turns out to be detrimental, it's pretty well impossible to get rid of afterwards.
What
and
sort of things could go wrong?
Well, let's take the example of killer bees, if you will, which are not a genetically modified organism per se, but they were genetically modified by crossing two types of bees and getting the wrong thing. You're not going to get rid of killer bees in the South now. They're there, and they become part of the habitat.
But that has nothing to do with genetically modified food.
The only difference between...
That's a natural development.
But the only difference between genetically modifying something and doing it through genetic...
Breeding
is time.
But so what? So, I mean, now we can genetically modify food and get much better food cheaper and faster. That's it. If we wait long enough, maybe we can modify it by breeding, but that takes a long time.
Anybody?
Well, to give one example that's caused some concern is that one sort of thing you can do with genetic modification is introduce pesticide resistance or kind of insect poisons into crops. And this is fine so long as the crop that has been modified only ends up targeting the species that you're trying to target. But an example that has occurred is that there are butterfly species that have been adversely impacted by flying into fields where the crops have been blessed with this genetically modified mm-hmm. pesticide as part of their internal production, and it can in fact wipe out large numbers of potentially beneficial insects. So it's not completely without hazard. On the other hand, it's obviously not without some benefit.
So how do you strike that balance? In other words, you let the cat out of the bag, those crops presumably will spread on their own to some extent.
Well, you know, not to sound too much like some kind of a liberal or something, that's what a regulatory system is designed for, so that you test these things, you find out whether they're working on scales that are reasonably likely to occur once you turn them loose. And if you find a problem, you either say, no, you can't do this, or you place regulations, it'll work. I know this is really kind of a bad thing to say, but that's one of the things that government does, and we expect the government to do it.
All right, anybody else before we move on? All right, here's one. Before we take a break here, we'll take one. This is from our website, a comment on our website. Alex has this to say. In certain circles, people say that humans appear small and insignificant compared to the universe at large. They point to things like the pale blue dot picture as evidence for this. However, in my study of biochemistry, I've discovered enormous life and complexity in the smallest of places. Is it more correct to view humans as small in the scope of the universe, large in relation to the microscopic worlds below our feet, or directly in the middle, neither large nor small?
Is there a D, all of the above?
All right. Or D, all of the above. Head.
Yeah, that's what I would go for. It's a scale is scale. We're big in certain things and small in other things. That's my final word on the matter.
All right. Anybody else?
Certainly, if you look at the picture of the stars or of this planet, the Earth is very small, right, in a relationship to the thing. And we think ourselves, naturally, particularly if you're religious, that we are in the center of the world, and we are not. And there are clearly millions of other planets where there are life. And
although not proven.
Not proved, absolutely not. And probably, if there are, so there are probably life that are more intelligent than us. And I certainly hope so.
So we're fairly insignificant then.
Yes.
Fred?
I sort of agree with Ed that it depends on what scale you're looking at. If, you know, any scale, if I'm talking myself versus microbes, I'm on a big scale. I'm talking myself versus the universe on a small scale. But we are definitely
on scale. I like it. It's all how you look at it. Let's take a break here. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. We hit the home stretch coming up on the Science Forum.
Support comes from Kern Compliance Services, LLC, Greenwich, New York. Legal and consulting services on regulatory issues for life insurance and annuity manufacturers and distributors. KernCompliance.com. The Old Warwick Bookshop, Warwick, New York. A Hudson River Valley bookseller specializing in new and vintage books, plus collectibles and curiosities. Open 7 days a week, yeoldwarwickbookshop.com. Pine Cobble School, Williamstown, Massachusetts. This week, all students devote a school day on multi-age math games research in celebration of Pi, the universal constant. A good beginning never ends, pinecobble.org. And Paradise Copies, Northampton, Massachusetts. Providing printing design for customers for over 20 years. From digital to offset, color copies, scans, logos, and more. ParadiseCopies.com.
one 800 348 2551 is our number. It is Vox Pop. It is the Science Forum, and what a fun show it has been. All right, we have some people commenting on some of our earlier questions from Facebook. Polly says, about the glow the caller saw emanating from some pine trees, it was possibly drifts of pollen that were illuminated by moonlight. When pines shed their pollen, it is as if the trees were enveloped in a bright veil. Nods? Anybody? Oh, yeah, George is nodding.
It's possible.
Yeah. And here's Pamela on Facebook. The ball is kept. This goes back to whether the ball in the lady's car was a barometer of sorts. And Pamela on Facebook says, the ball is kept in a room that is the same temperature year-round. And the reason I asked, this is Pamela. And the reason I asked is I had the same discussion with myself. Does high pressure push in on the surface of the ball and so make it squishier? Or does it press out and expand it more? Looking forward to the homework. And that's good, Pamela, because we always try to leave Ed with some homework. And Ed, this is going to be yours, right?
Right. That's my life.
And here's the problem, Pamela. It'll be about four shows before he actually has done it. So
just to give the gag away, Pamela, you got it right.
Okay. Oh, all right, George. Fair enough. Well, you saved Ed some work. Let's go back to the phones. Don in Great Barrington. Don, you're on.
Hello, gentlemen. I'm not a real scientist, but it occurs to me that the firmness of the ball will change not an iota because the air pressure inside is going to remain the same relative to the ball. As the ambient temperature increases or decreases in the room, so will the temperature of the air inside. And as we all know, the volume increases as the, you know, with the expansion of the ball. The air pressure inside will still be the same relative to the outside pressure, and I think there will be no change at all in the firmness of the ball.
I think George is he may be shaking his head, Don. Go ahead, George.
There's a fixed amount of air in the ball. The ball is sealed. If you decrease the outside pressure, that air must expand because the pressure's lower on it. That pushes against the outer diaphragm of the ball and increases its stiffness.
It makes
it less stiff.
I agree,
but if the ambient temperature increases or decreases and the ball is in that ambient air, so will change the temperature of the air inside and therefore the density and the expansiveness of that of the ball's air.
Well, you certainly can change it if you change the temperature significantly. That's why I asked the question, is the ball kept in a room with relatively constant temperature?
And Pamela said, indeed, that is the case.
If the temperature is constant, then the temperature is not the factor we're looking at.
Well, Don, thanks a lot. And you have a 60-cycle hum on that phone, and let's get the ground fixed for the next program. Heidi in Durham. Heidi, you're up.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hello.
My call has to do with the theory of relativity. And my question is, what sort of research has the scientific community done that has practical application, and where you see the research headed in the future?
Ivor.
Well, if you take the GPS system, then you are measuring the speed of at least four satellites which circle the Earth. And to get the right time and the right temperature, they had to be corrected by the theory of relativity. The biggest correction is due to the gravity, but there's also a correction due to the speed of these things. And if you didn't have the theory of relativity, you couldn't use the GPS system because you couldn't correct for it, and it would make nonsense things. That's one practical application of theory of relativity.
How about that?
Okay.
Work for you, Heidi?
That does. It gives me some additional food for thought.
Thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. Now, Ira, the GPS satellites, they are not geosynchronous. They are lower in orbit. They actually
circle
orbit.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Bill in Latham. Bill, you're on.
Hey, how you doing, Ray?
Good.
I really like you and Bob Berman. I like that show for the astronomy.
I think that's next week, I don't know. It's coming up soon.
No. Don't worry about it. Okay. I can still get it.
Fair enough, because there's no room for Bob in the studio at this point.
You have four scientists.
Yeah, that's right.
All right.
That's one.
I love
Berman.
It. You know, like, all right, I'm 60 this year, all right?
All right.
So this question is kind of really important to me. I don't want to get into genetically modified foods.
Okay.
I know white pines might have been subject for the last few decades with blister rust. And monarchs, I understand, are really having a tough time right now. And nicotines are affecting the bees for some reason.
Nicotines?
And, you know, here's my question. And I love Norway maples, by the way. Is there some way that we can recover what we've lost over the last, let's say, 30 years in terms of development, in terms of trees? We've cut away the Amazon rainforest a lot and all of that in our logging operations. Is there some kind of, like, Fibonacci algorithm or something that we could write into our laws or our understanding to kind of restore what we've destroyed? That's my question.
That is a heck of a question, Bill, and we'll throw it out to the panel. Thank you very much. George, you look like you have an answer.
Talk about sequestration.
All right, George has no answer.
What you call destroying the nature or whatever is what other people called development. And so, you know, clearly the world is going to change. We get more people here. We need more food. We need everything. And so the world is changing. And people have to accept that the world is changing. You can't go back 200 years. I just looked it up in year 19, I think it was 1850. There were 1.5 billion people on the Earth. Now we are over 7 billion people.
Yep.
And so it's clearly you have to change, you have to cut down forests, you have to do various things.
Fred?
Reforestation is going to be based on whether people themselves decide. If they remove trees, they're going to have to replant them. Because if you take away trees without allowing any of the seeds or any part left over, trees are not going to replenish themselves. So people, you need to replenish the forests, at least for our future.
Well, there's no question at all that reforestation is possible. And we're living right here in New York State with one of the finest examples of that on the planet. In around 1880, much of the forest in the New York State had been cut down for one purpose or another, including for agriculture. And there's more forested land in New York State now than there was in 1880. So this is the kind of thing that it depends on what people decide they want to do. And if they have enough incentive or reason to do it, they will probably reforest.
You're listening to the Science Forum on Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551. We go to Lima in Liberty. You're on.
Hi, it's Lima, like Lima Bean.
Hello, Lima Bean. You're on.
Greetings to all my experts there. I find this show so stimulating and diverse that my mentality is going in all different directions. I called for one purpose and got involved with your GMOs and so forth. And the way I look at it, everything that's happening from Fukushima to the oil spills to the fracking to what I'm going to ask about is the other day, I looked out my window, as a thousand times before. I lived in the country. I moved into Liberty, and I've seen the skies with those chemtrails, contrails, whatever we want to call them, in spirals, in X's, darkening a beautiful sunshiny day, and it's a big controversy as to what is going on up there. I received no answers from EPA. You call airports, we don't have time to look up there and so forth, and I have books on it. For years I've been studying it. What can you tell me?
All right.
I spent quite a bit of time looking at that problem, and I can tell you that if there is anything in the material that's coming out of those airplanes that would be not produced by JP4, jet propulsion fuel, it couldn't be there because the plane couldn't fly. They can't put anything else in the material that's going into the fuel that wouldn't gum up the engines and destroy the planes.
Have they changed the formulation on the
not at all.
Fuel?
This goes back to the subject of dew point. When you have material coming out of an airplane and it's under pressure and you relieve that pressure, it cools off extremely fast. It's called adiabatic cooling. And that produces a cloud, and the cloud is linear because that's what the plane is doing.
So then why and you see it all over the place, why the fascination with the so-called chemtrails? Is it just a mindset that people now are focusing on this? Has it always been the same?
Well, it really has always been the same. It depends on how fast the winds are blowing up there is how fast the trail stays there. And that depends to a good extent on where the jet stream is at the time, and that depends a lot on the year that's happening. So some years they last longer than others.
But it has to do with jet engines.
That's right.
Before we had jet engines, there were no trails up there.
Mm. Well, Lama, that's a
thank you.
Great call.
I remember years ago as a young girl, we used to see writing in the sky.
Oh, yeah.
Designs, but now they're like sausage-like. They obliterate the light, and it's been proven Midwest that they found many, many toxic chemicals coming from some of these.
Well, that's
and one whistleblower who worked with them asked, "What am I spraying? Don't ask questions. Just do it."
Okay.
And it makes you wonder. People get ill, a lot of sinuses, a lot of this and that. And I still feel that there's something else going on, but then, I'm not the expert.
You can easily do the research even online to find out what can possibly be put in that into jet propulsion fuel.
Well, now what's stopping it from being like a crop duster that has a separate nozzle that's shooting?
It could very well be, but there's no reason to even suggest that jet airplanes up there who are traveling, thousands of miles with people, have something on the back that's sending stuff out. There's no reason to even suggest it.
Lima, thanks a lot for the call. Anybody else want to comment on this before we move on? Hearing nothing, we'll move on. Let's go to Edward in Lake Katrine. Edward, you're on.
Hi, a quick statement just to correct the record. One of your scientists said religion says we're at the center of the universe. That was a statement of religion from the Middle Ages. So he's gone back 600 years to dredge that one up. Okay, so
all right.
Just to comment on that fact. But I'm calling about ocean acidification.
Okay.
I'm reading a book by Elizabeth Colbert, The Sixth Extinction. And she quotes a number of scientists who are really worried about ocean acidification caused by CO2 and caused by burning oil and coal and pumping CO2 into the ocean. And she's writing about an extinction of our whole planet life-wise. I'd like to know why scientists are disagreeing about this, and if they're disagreeing and there's no one sense of what's happening, how are we going to deal with this issue if there's
okay.
No consensus.
All right, scientists are supposed to disagree, I think.
Yeah,
that's
I know,
how
but
science
there should
is
be a consensus.
All right, well, let's put this to the panel.
So I would say that the ocean, first of all, is not acidic. It's alkaline. It's like 8. The pH is like 8. And they measured pH.
It's acidification. It's not acid in it now. It's acidification.
In other words,
it's becoming more acidic. And there's no question at all that the ocean is becoming more acidic over time.
But they have measured it.
They have measured it and proven.
I'm going to say,
that the ocean is becoming more acidic.
I'm going to tell you how much acidic has become in 25 years. Mm-hmm. It's gone from 0.01 to 0.04. The 0.798.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's a small 8, and that's the surface of the ocean. And that's the measurement which are just coming out from the National Academy of Sciences.
A chemist will tell you that a small change in pH can make a huge difference in the chemical equilibria, especially the carbonate equilibria in the ocean.
But
this can affect biological organisms that depend on a precise balance of pH in order to carry out their life cycles.
You depend on the exact pH, too. Your blood is exactly 7.4. And if you get 7.5 or 7.6, you are done for. But the fact is that the blood is highly regulated. And the fact is that the ocean has changed the pH all through life. And there are all sorts of species in the ocean that's come and gone. I mean, we can't accept that things always should be the same.
It's true that during the time of the dinosaurs, the CO2 content of the atmosphere was about 100 times what it is now. And apparently during that period of time, there was no ice, for example, at the North or the South Poles, because the temperature of the Earth was warm enough for that to happen. So if that were true, then the oceans would certainly be more acidic than they are at the present time. So things come and go, and creatures come and go. And the question is, do we want that to happen or not? So it's
well, also, is if it's happened 200 million years ago, is it something that we can really make a huge dent in,
no,
regardless of how we change our behavior? I think that's the crux of the whole thing.
Well, one interesting thing that we did find out is during the last big blackout, when a lot of the Midwest power plants went offline, they did some flying around New York City and discovered that the CO2 content after about 24 hours of the atmosphere dropped quite a bit.
Mm, I remember that.
All it's required is really the desire.
All right. Now, we're just about out of time, panel. Here's one from, this is an email at voxpopwamc.org. During the recent sub-zero weather, my outside fridge froze solid 2 bottles of a 4-pack of beer, yet the other 2 beers had not a sign of ice crystals. What's up with that? We have 1 minute.
Heterogeneous versus homogeneous nucleation.
Or the alcohol content of the beer.
Or it could be the alcohol content.
So higher alcohol would not freeze.
Yes.
Genius. All right. Well, let's see. Do we have another
part? And the alcohol content on each beer is an approximation of each batch. So one bottle could have more than the other, but an average.
But they have light beer and regular beer. Maybe the light beer froze and the regular beer not.
Could be.
All right. Now, this is a 4-pack of beer, but it doesn't say they're the same beers. See, this is why it's always fun to drink with scientists. All right. We are done. Guys, well done. I want to thank all of you for being here, and thank Ivor and George and Ed and Fred and everybody who called in today. Support comes from Ward's Nursery and Garden Center, Great Barrington, for fragrance and bloom, primrose, hyacinth, orchids, herbs, tulips, and weekend garden classes, wardsnursery.com. Saratoga Bridges, Boston Spa, New York, a community resource for people with disabilities and their families, supported employment day services at more, saratogabridges.org. Black Dog and Leventhal, offering the Black Dog Opera Library 2-CD set in Italian and English, featuring La Traviata with libretto, blackdogandleventhal.com. And Rhinebeck Kitchen and Bath, with locations in Rhinebeck and Coxsackie, offering design, project management, and installation throughout the Hudson Valley since 1997. RhinebeckKitchenAndBath.com. Well, I apologize to everybody who was left on the line. It was a popular show today, and thank you for calling in and making it an interesting one. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who handled the controls. Thanks to Anonymous Sandy, who screened your calls. Thanks to our producer. Today, Ian Pickus was our producer. Jessica's on vacation, so Ian did the job. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's Food Friday, and that's always exciting. Stay tuned for a news update.